This week on Out of the Air, our whole show features the multi-award-winning broadcast journalist, best-selling author, and longtime host of NPR's Weekend Edition, Scott Simon, discussing his storied career along with his new book, Ulysses S. Cat and Other Animals I Have Known. Our spotlight, the Depot Gallery and Museum exhibit, Feathers, featuring Bessie Fleek, Christina Gnowski, and Christina Hubble.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. And is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. We'd like to welcome to our Art on the Air spotlight, representing actually a special exhibit that's coming up at the Depot in Beverly Shores, and it'll be running in June, and she'll be telling us all about it. She's one of the participants, and there'll be three of them, as Bessie Fleek is with us here to talk about this wonderful exhibit that's coming up and featuring two other people that we've had on the show. Betsy, welcome to Art of the Year spotlight.
Oh, thank you so much, Larry and Esther.
Yeah.
Glad to be here.
Exciting.
Since you've never been on the show before, we want to briefly ask you a little bit about you and your art, and then we'll talk about this exhibit that you're part of. Well, we want you.
I would love to talk about my art. I actually started painting watercolor birds during COVID. I'm after I retired and I picked up a paintbrush, and I found that I really, really enjoyed and loved painting the local birds of the dunes. And that's all I focus on is the local birds of the area as well as their habitats. So it started out with a master naturalist class and then led to an art class. And I've been doing birds ever since then. That's about me. I used to do global IT and traveled all over the world.
Ah.
So I'm glad to be here in my art studio representing a portion of bird artists in northern Indiana. We have such a diverse habitat here in the Indiana Dunes, and it's one way for at least me to acknowledge how diverse and how biodiverse this whole area is that we live in.
And as many different types of artists as there are birds, do you favor a particular bird that you find that you paint more than others?
That's a great question. I get a lot of calls for cardinals, mainly because there's a mythological thought behind them that they represent dearly departed. But I personally like to paint birds in their quirky natures. So a particular tilt of the head, or since their eyes are located on the side of their heads and they don't stare at you like we do, they have to turn their head to actually see you. And it kind of looks like they're questioning what you have to say.
Right. Do you like any of the, there's herons and egrets and those types of birds to do also?
I love the great blue heron. They are majestic as they, I would love to emulate them, and they can stalk the shorelines of ponds and lakes as they wait for their little fish and frogs, those things to come up where they can spear them with their giant bill.
Birds are just as captivating like realistically as they are whimsically in cartoons and stuff. There's just something about their personalities that are so charming.
I think there's many different ways to capture the spirit of the birds. And that shows up in our local indigenous cultures in the area, as well as the other two artists that are going to be at the Beverly Shores Depot show with me on June 12th.
How did that come about?
Well, I'd be happy to tell. I grew up in Beverly Shores, and then I moved away for a while. And when I came back and I started painting, I knew some folks at Beverly Shores Depot. And they said, well, you're painting. How would you like to do a show at the depot? And I said, well, I have birds. And I think it's a perfect match for what the depot is, and as well as located in the national park itself, or close to, by the Great Marsh, that it would be a great idea if I invited two of my bird artist friends, and that's Christina Nowski and Christine Hubble. We all have very, very different styles, but we all capture the spirit of the birds that live in this area. And together, the three of us will not only have an art show, it's going to be June 12th, and the reception is from 5 to 7 at the Beverly Shores Depot in Beverly Shores, Indiana. It's right on the corner of 12 and Broadway. Just put it in your browser. You can't miss it. And then, but what we wanted to do as a group, since we all take different inspirations for our paintings on birds, is on that Sunday, the 14th of June at 10 a.m., we will be having what we call a bird art-ucation experience, where each one of us meet at the depot at 10. Each one of us will do a different activity that kind of demonstrates how we get inspiration for painting. And my particular one is I love to do what I call interpretive strolling. So interpretive strolling is where you actually get out in nature and you start looking at your environment. So for instance, like when birds, you may not know this, but birds rely on insects to feed their babies. And when we take the leaves away during the fall, it takes away a lot of the homes for the insects. So there's a trickle-down effect where you may not see any birds in your neighborhood and you wonder why, and it's pretty much because there's no food source for their babies. So interpretive strolling kind of brings those pieces together, at least for me, to understand how important the habitat is for the sustainability of the bird population in this area. That's what we're going to have on June 12th.
Yeah.
And remember to come in June 14th at 10 a.m., 10 to 12, and join us for either a birding activity with Christina Nowski, interpretive strolling with myself, or nature journaling with Christine Hubble. I'm very, very excited. We are very excited to make this an interactive art experience in the area. And we're trying to combine the national park along with the artists that are local to the area and maybe bring some life or breath into the exhibit.
Well, that's going to be running June 12th through July 5th. You can see the special activities. You can find out information online. And the depot is open on Fridays 1 to 5, Saturday 10 to 5, and Sundays 1 to 3, besides the special events. Thank you so much, Betsy, for coming on Art of the Air and Spotlight and sharing this.
Thank you.
Yes, it sounds so fantastic. Thank you.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Emberforge Consulting. With end-to-end expertise in learning strategy, design, and implementation, Emberforge turns your organization's knowledge into impact. To learn more, visit emberforgeconsulting.com. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, B-R-E-C-H.
Hi there, this is Public Radio theme composer BJ Lederman, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Scott Simon to Art on the Air. Scott is one of America's most admired writers and broadcasters. He has reported from all 50 states, 5 continents, and 10 wars. His books have chronicled character and characters in War and Peace, Sports and Art, tragedy, and comedy. In 2025, he was inducted into the Radio Hall of Fame. His most recent book, Ulysses S. Cat and Other Animals I Have Known, is charming and written in a deceptively breezy fashion that inspires an intimate connection to the stories. You feel part of his greater family. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Scott. But I want to say thank you personally for documenting Elisa's words, Furnace of Love. It really allowed me to check into my backpack of emotions, tucked away always, so you know they don't engulf me. But so thank you so much. It's so wonderful to meet you.
Thank you. Very good to meet you. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Well, Scott, we our show, we always start off with our background story and about the book. It caused me to go back, and we'll talk about it later, through all the animals that came into my life. But what we want to do with our show, and I think maybe the people that maybe listen to NPR obviously know this, but your origin story and a background. And I always like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Scott.
Oh, God. I mean, I don't spend much time thinking about that. You know, I was born well to a wonderful mother and father who were both entertainers. My father, in particular, was a comedian. And my mother worked in nightclubs and did odd jobs. You know, she sold clothes on Michigan Avenue. She sold clothes on State Street. She was a hostess at restaurants up and down Rush Street. My father was a comedian, and he had some very good years, but he was in the process of drinking himself into an early death. He died at the age of 48. I was 16. I grew up in times which were very tumultuous. You know, it was the time of the civil rights movement. It was the time of the assassinations of Martin Luther King and John F. Kennedy and Robert F. Kennedy. And I was sort of drawn in by the times, much as anything else. We put out an underground newspaper. I was also Illinois State Student Council president, of all things. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, that journalism just kind of intrigued and interested me. And I began to make my own way, sort of creating my own, my own niche insofar as I could. I wound up working at Channel 11 in Chicago. For a wonderful guy named John Calloway, who was the news director, and I became a reporter there, and I heard NPR, and I began to freelance, and that eventually led them to offer me a job. In those days, NPR really didn't have anybody outside of New York, Washington, and then one person in Southern California. So this was opening up to the heart of America, if you please. I mean, they have local stations all across the country, but no reporters. So I was lucky to open our Chicago bureau and do a lot of great stories and eventually get sent around the world. And here I am today.
That's true. So, Scott, what about that childhood, though? How? Because your father was also, he had a radio show. Is that correct? And were you part of that entertainment life of the family, and how were the grandparents involved?
Well,
and in school, did you show an aptitude for writing, like elementary school, middle school, high school?
Boy, I'm not sure what my teachers in element. Yeah, I think I was considered. Yes, I showed an aptitude for writing. Yes. Which became more apparent when I was in high school. Although I will add parenthetically, I was doing a book event in Chicago the other night, and my old geometry teacher came up to her 19-year-old daughter and said, "By the way, I think you should know your father was a terrible math student." It was a highlight of the night. God bless Mr. Geis. I love him, still love him, our teacher. When you grow up in a family of entertainers, that's just the family business. I know that sounds a little bit strange, but the older I grew, I guess I understood that not everybody did that for a living. But when I was young, I just, you know, my mother had a story years ago that I had a friend named Bunky Cook. Or at least we called him Bunky Cook. I can't imagine his parents called him Bunky, but in any event, he was a Bunky's father was a drummer in a nightclub band. And my mother maintains that we met some other kid on the playground and asked, "What's your father's act?" I mean, I don't. You know, but it was a way of earning a living. So it seemed very very natural to me. My father did have a radio show, but I must say radio shows were sort of, you know, different in those days. It was a comedy show. So the whole idea was to try and be funny between commercials and records. And, you know, he used to sing songs and he had these catchphrases. "It's a beautiful day today." I don't know, you know, he made up
words.
Well,
see, but all of that, you know, in your book, you talk about singing songs to the animals. And I mean, I make up songs for everyone in my life, you know, so it started young.
I think we do. I mean, I think we sing songs to our children. I think we sing songs to our pets. In my current book, if I may, Ulysses S. Cat and Other Animals I Have Known. Yeah, I talk about the fact that I hardly think this is the most unusual thing about me. I absolutely do sing to our dog, Daisy. I've sang to our daughters when they were growing up. And as a matter of fact, I still fall into it every now and then, which is not always appreciated the older they get. But for that matter, our animals seem to appreciate it when I sing to them.
Yeah, the attention that they get like that, it's very much so. Of course, I have a theater background and mostly musical theater, and I sing all the time. I break into song for different things and the animals we had and my daughters and things like that. So I completely understand that.
In many ways, young children and animals they call out the same wavelength of communication in us.
They do. Well, now we're going to take a little bit more of your history. Obviously, you're in Chicago. Then you started going out and you started covering things all over the country and the world. Tell us a little about that, the reporting part of what you've been doing.
Boy, I don't know where to begin. I've been all over the world. I've been blessed and fortunate to see so much of the world.
Well, lots of people, you know, there's a lot of times when you enter a career, but was there a defining moment that you knew that you had a genuine love and talent for it that puts you ahead of maybe all the other people who were trying to do the same thing?
Oh, I don't know exactly. I think one of the things that there were two big stories that probably got me attention that was unplanned. I was one of the young reporters that covered years ago. There were a group of American Nazis that wanted to march through Skokie, Illinois,
right.
Predominantly Jewish suburb of Chicago. Was in those days. I'm not sure now. And they wound up winning a very prominent legal case. Defended by the American Civil Liberties Union. ACBUT, however, actually did not wind up marching through Skokie, but ultimately through Marquette Park in Chicago, which was the neighborhood in which their headquarters was located. But this was a story that went on one way or another for a year and a half or 2 years, and I covered various parts of it. And this was a very controversial story because there are people who believe in the First Amendment and free speech, but think, but not Nazis, for goodness sakes. And the people who defended them at the American Civil Liberties Union, I remember their David Goldberger was their lead attorney or the lead attorney of the case, and David Hamlin was then head of the Illinois American Civil Liberties Union. They always used to say, "Our client is the First Amendment," which I thought was a good way of stating the case. But boy. That's a story that got a lot of attention and is very controversial. I was telling someone the other day, well, this is not a story that made it on the air, but it is a story that that convinced me that I was in a blessed and exceptional profession. I, to this day, and I suppose I never will, have a driver's license. Mm-hmm. Just didn't. So the Nazis had a press conference in their headquarters on the southwest side of Chicago, and I got there by L and by bus. And it was after the press conference, and I was standing outside on, I believe, Marquette Park Boulevard, waiting for the bus to be able to take it to the L to go back into the loop. And who should pull up on the street right next to me but Frank Collin, who was head of the American Nazi Party. And he said, where are you going? And I told him to the loop. And he said, well, I'm going down to see our attorneys. Come on, I'll give you a lift. And I guess reflexively, I felt like I couldn't say no, you know? So next thing I know, I was in a white van with a swastika on the side. And we were tooling down the Dan Ryan Expressway. And people are coming up. There's a swastika on the side of the van. And they're beeping their horn. And they're swearing. And, you know, you Nazi so-and-so. And I'm in the passenger window going, oh, I'm not really with him. I mean, obviously, I survived and was perfectly fine. But what an experience that was. And it was a very important story to cover at that particular point, because it did make you ask, what do we think about the values of freedom of expression? What do we really think about, do they work if they don't work for the most obnoxious among us? I, at the same time, too, of course, I mean, you know, I interviewed many people in Skokie who said that they felt just personally torn up by the fact that these Nazis wanted to march again, because they thought they'd come to America, a safe place, and then they were going to see people with armbands marching down their streets all over again. Now, it should be said, I don't want to say got to know, but I certainly interviewed a number of that group of Nazis. Let's just put it this way. They were not rocket scientists. You did not feel that they had the capacity to create a lot of misery. But, I mean, I wouldn't want to underestimate them. Let's put it that way. And so I could see where particularly the survivors of the Holocaust were particularly affronted. And it made you wonder if anything, including the First Amendment, was worth that kind of desecration.
Yeah, so it's a fragile line.
It is a fragile line. That's well said. And so I was glad to tell that story, and I think it got some attention. The other one I should mention, I think it predated that, is I happened to be a young reporter. I believe I was freelancing for NPR when Mayor Daley died, which was totally unexpected. And so there was the commemoration of Mayor Daley for a national audience, which I think was important. I still remember a line I wrote when I was very, very young. It began his on-the-air obituaries by saying he was a boss, a builder, and a White Sox fan. Not a bad line.
Right.
And then, of course, the political tumult that followed was absolutely extraordinary. And, it was even, in a Chicago kind of way, even very fun. So, in any event, those were two stories that got a lot of attention. And then, you know, ultimately, if you're covering city council wars, why don't you cover an actual war? So I began to do that.
I remember the thing about Mayor Daley, the old Mayor Daley, is how he would code switch his language. He could be fairly eloquent, but then when he didn't want to answer the answer, he would kind of get that his kind of hard Irish
Bridgeport. Brogue accent.
Yeah, Bridgeport brogue there.
Oh, he, you know, I I didn't have a lot of direct. The only time I think I really met him in person, interestingly enough, when I was a high school student. And I had a collection of political campaign buttons. I wish I knew where it was today, but I was getting them all over Chicago, and I was even writing away for them. And I went down to Cook County Democratic headquarters. This was in the old Sherman House Hotel, to get some campaign buttons. And the nice lady at the desk said something like, "Oh, Mayor Daley." I said, "Well, look, here's Mayor Daley." And he walked out of her room. And he'd been meeting with people there. And she said, "Oh, Mayor, this is a high school student." And I, God bless, I shook his hand. And he said, "Are you and your family good Democrats?" And I mean, the short answer to that is my mother was a Democrat. My auntie Chris was the family Republican. And so I said something like, "I think so." And everybody laughed, you know, it was surrounded by that coterie of people. But, you know, that in the period that followed was obviously very important in Chicago. And I mean, ultimately, I mean, I was there when Harold Washington was elected mayor, and that was certainly a momentous moment in the city's history and national history, for that matter.
Well, same with Jane Byrne prior to Washington.
Oh, I had such great memories of Jane Byrne's campaign. I had a lot of fun. I mean, I got to travel with her a lot and would sit back in the car with her and interview her. And she was very much underestimated at the time that I was covering her. And then, of course, it snowed and her chances grew better. I had a great time covering Chicago politics. What can I tell you?
And it does
prepare you. I've been telling this. Maybe New York, maybe Los Angeles, but I don't think anything quite prepares you to cover the world as covering Chicago does. I mean, I remember years ago, going out to the Northwest Side by L. There was a bombing in a storefront overnight, storefront headquarters for a Serbian nationalist group. And nobody was hurt, but it was a bombing, so lots of broken glass. And I remember walking around in the remnants of the office that had been where the bomb had gone off, and seeing pictures of older Serbian revolutionaries, black and white photos hanging, and thinking, my God, what kind of statement were they trying to make about a war that was decades older, had been over for decades, not quite recognizing the fact that I would, within a few years, I would be covering a renewal of that war and the siege of Sarajevo.
Before we leave Chicago, I know you're a strong fan and written a book about the Northsiders, and of course, cover that. Tell us a little about your relationship about the Cubs with your own life.
There is no life outside of the Cubs. Well, look, I've been a Cub fan all my life. I also, by the way, wish the White Sox well.
Yeah.
I'm not one of those Cub fans that wish ill for the White Sox. I came of age at a time when the Cubs, of course, were famously bad, but had a couple of luminously great players, Ernie Banks, of course, being one, and then I would also include Billy Williams.
Oh, yes.
And eventually, almost unpredictably, the team got stronger and had luminaries, including, I can go around the bases.
You can do the whole list.
obviously Ernie Banks at first, and then Glenn Beckert and Don Kessinger at short. Ron Santo at third. Fergie Jenkins, Gene Oliver. Just an absolutely great team. And then, of course, there was the emotional destruction, the washout of losing to the New York Mets at what seemed to be the last second in 1969, when they seemed to be on. Yeah, you know, there was something so definitively Cub-like about that, coming so close and yet falling short. And that, you know, that sort of intensified the relationship. That made things That made you feel a little bit closer and a little bit aware of the human costs. I mean, you know, it was the era of Steve Goodman singing, "Do they still sing the blues in Chicago?" Whenever peasants pan at season rolls around, you know, but I don't have to sing that song for you. But that was all part of that era that I think cemented my relationship with the Cubs as a fan. I should also explain a personal relationship. My godfather, Jack Brickhouse, was the Chicago Cub announcer for many years.
Yes.
Also, by the
one
way,
and only.
The White Sox for many years. And so I grew up saying, "Hey, hey!"
So, we all grew up listening to that as well.
As well as the song, "Hey, Hey, Holy Mackerel, No Doubt About It."
"Hey, Hey, Holy Mackerel, No Doubt About It, the Cubs are..."
Yes.
So, but also my Auntie Marion was married to Charlie Grimm. Charlie Grimm had been the Cub first baseman and had been the manager. And I was recently back at the Art Institute because the Norman Rockwell original of his painting called The Dugout has been hung in, I believe, Salon 262 of the Art Institute of Chicago. And so I had at least those two personal relationships with the Cubs. And so it was unthinkable. I mean, was I going to become a Marlins fan, you know?
And I have to mention Randy Hundley, too, my best friend. So I forgot him in that lineup of great Cubbies.
Oh, yeah. Great catcher. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, you know, after a brief break, we'll return to our guest today on Art in the Air, Scott Simon. Art in the Air listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show? Whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. And we return to our guest today on Art in the Air, Scott Simon, on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM. Well, Scott, you started to talk about your overseas travels. We've just finished with the Cubs and everything. So tell us some of the highlights of that and maybe how eventually you landed on doing some of the other things you do for what you are right now for NPR.
Well, I guess the first war I was sent to cover was El Salvador, which was a civil war happening between rebels and the government, several different rebel groups at that particular point. And, you know, it was a torturous time in the history of El Salvador at that particular point. And I was there covering it because, of course, there was always the question of should the United States become involved at all, or further involvement, I should say. The United States had sent military advisors to El Salvador, whom, by the way, I never really saw. Stayed at a different hotel. They were very small in number. I think 52 is the number that sticks in my mind. We did meet one socially while shopping once, as a matter of fact, and he was there was a long history of rivalry and strife in El Salvador, and he was saying that they were working with the Salvadoran military. There, of course, were the inevitable concerns that the rebel groups in El Salvador were leftist and were therefore would be aligned with Fidel Castro or the Soviet Union, for that matter. I think we have seen history bear it out that I'm not sure that's quite the case, but in any event, this was all part of a larger movement going on in Central America. It was also part of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua and various movements also in Guatemala and other places. So you can never be sure why of something like this, but there were four Dutch journalists who were killed once while making contact with a rebel group, were killed by government soldiers while making contact with a rebel group in the jungles. And I had just been put on the enemies list in El Salvador. 25 of us reporters who, for one particular reason or another, were put on the enemies list. And my editor came down to take me out. I said I didn't want to go out. I wanted to stay and do the story. So I did. But my crew and I promised to be very careful. So the four Dutch journalists were killed. And there were good questions as to being raised about why. And my recording engineer, Leo Delacola, and I went over to the morgue where they're being held, hoping to be able to talk to some of the people there, off the record, obviously, about what they had seen, what the wounds were like. And so we went around to a back entrance. I figured if we went around to the front entrance, they would be looking at IDs and taking names. And since I was on the enemies list, that wouldn't be good. So it was because of that we knocked on a back door, and whoever answered the door, we must have arrived at a time that was close to when people from the Dutch embassy were coming. So we never said we weren't from the Dutch embassy, let me put it that way. So we let us in. And we saw the bodies, and that included very close-up wounds, which would suggest powder burns, which would suggest that they were not shot at a distance, but close range, which is to say, executed. And that was a big story that I got really totally by happenstance, you know, through no particular dint of effort of my own, my engineer, Leo Delacola. But that turned out to be, as we judge these things in journalism, to be a very, very good story at the time. And, I just went from one war to another after that.
And during that, Scott, are you able to stay in touch with your family to let them know how you are, or are you so involved that with what you're doing that
this is long before cell phones and email. So, and right. Of course, I wasn't married or then or have children. So it was to stay in touch with my mother and then a wonderful guy she married, my stepfather, Ralph Newman. And it was intermittent. I don't remember how long, but people also paid big money for long distance phone calls in those days. So, there wasn't. I'm not sure there was any contact at those at those months I was away. Not certainly that I remember offhand.
So let's bring you back to. After you're covering your foreign things, how did that matriculate for you starting to land back in the States a little bit? And I guess what have ultimately brought you to Weekend Edition, which is, one of your current gigs at NPR?
Well, we were looking at that particular time. Public radio had a very popular show that needs no introduction called Prairie Home Companion.
Yeah.
And there was some feeling that we wanted something on NPR Saturday morning that would be kind of set the table for Prairie Home Companion at Saturday night, which was the high audience tentpole. So the whole idea was to create some kind of Saturday news magazine with personality and zest and range freely all over the world, and yet would have a weekend feel because it would talk about arts and talk about, imagine this for public radio, sports, because I was a sports fan. So in any event, I had done some fill-in hosting for Bob Edwards on Morning Edition, and I had done a little fill-in hosting on All Things Considered with Susan Stamberg. So my name was thrown into the hopper. We did pilots, and the show got picked up, and it's been on the air for 40 years.
I know. And I always listen for the first part of your show to Ron Elving. That's the most important part. And if for some reason I sleep through that, I always listen to it. it's repeated on WBEZ an hour after the 2 hours. I said, okay, I gotta hear at least that part.
So you sleep through Ron Elving.
Well,
I will take some pleasure in telling him this, Larry.
Yeah, well, it's not intentional because it's, you know, 7 a.m. and I have the earphone in listening, and once in a while you do that. So I do make sure.
So you're also asleep for my weekly essay, right?
No, I always make sure I catch the first part of the show that I missed on the repeat on WBEZ from our station. So. And everything. So, yeah, it's an interesting show to listen to. It's something I look very much forward to as far as completing my morning on Saturdays and everything. I don't like the word fan, but I'm definitely an admirer of the show and how you handle it. And I like the variety of what you have there. Things that you cover, you know, it's new. There's some hard news, but it's given kind of a soft touch a little bit. It's a little easy way to have that come across, so.
Well, that's the idea. That's the idea, and it's important to us. What we have learned over the years, and it's in the inevitable audience surveys, is that people tend. We have a two-hour show. People tend to listen to it for more than an hour on the average, which is unheard of these days. And so we try and be companionable. We try and go through the whole vicissitudes of the week with people. We try and tell them what they need to know. We try and tell them stuff that just might be interesting. We try and make them laugh a little when we can. We try and let them know what's interesting. We try and unroll things before their eyes if we can, and do it with a sense of narrative.
Sure. Well, you know, one thing I wanted to I'll also bring up, before we get to your book, because that's ultimately what we want to get here at the end, is when you received the award, the Kiplinger Award, in your speech, you talked much about the state of journalism today, and maybe you want to comment on that. I mean, it's certainly a different kind of environment, but I remember Ted Koppel said something interesting when CNN first came on, is pointing a camera at an event is not journalism. And so, but anyway, what give us some of the reflections that you did in that speech.
Well, of course, Ted, I must say, was absolutely right. My concern now, huge overall concern, is that people are finding the news they want and are closing themselves off deliberately, intentionally, and algorithmically from information that might in any way question their view of the world. And that concerns me because I don't think that I think if that's the way we're getting informed, it's bad for democracy because that prevents us from having a conversation over any common points, and it doesn't make for a happy circumstance trying to make a country move forward democratically and undertake change. You know, almost anything, any event happens these days, and there is a left-wing take and there is a right-wing take. And it gets even smaller than those particular echo chambers, and that concerns me. And I think too much news is sort of engineered to tell an audience, yes, you're right. Whatever you're thinking, you're right, and we're going to take a few minutes here to tell you exactly why you're right.
That's true.
I also don't think that's news. I mean, I think one of the most valuable things we can do in the news industry is to challenge conventions of viewpoint. I mean, I remember years ago, we were doing a story on a proposed gun control measure in the state of Maryland that was on the ballot. And to this day, some of the most pointed and vociferous opponents of gun control, opponents that I have ever met and interviewed, were residents of the inner city of Baltimore, who were black. And I think a lot of white voters might have stereotyped them, of course they'll be for gun control. But they would say to me, well, maybe when you call the police in your neighborhood, they're there in 2 minutes. But here we call the police and never come.
Wow.
And, you know, and what you call, phrase then, was Saturday Night Special, I call that my home defense mechanism.
Sure.
And then, feeling like the wounded voice of NPR, I would say, but yes, you know, according to statistics, any gun you keep in your home is more likely to be used in some kind of, inter-family dispute or stolen and used against you. And they would say, well, you let me worry about that. You just give me what I need to protect me and my family.
Right.
And our audience, a lot of people just went nuts. It was in the early days of email, and they were, there must be something wrong. But wait, these are residents of the inner city of Baltimore. Certainly they are in favor of gun control. And as I told our staff at the time, to me, that made the story much more, even more valuable to do, to understand a viewpoint which was authentic and valid and voiced by people. And
very present.
Yeah. Different from what they might have assumed, certainly what they were hearing. So I was very glad when we did that story. And over the years, there have been other examples that conveniently escaped me, but I think that's some of the most valuable kind of work that we can be doing.
You're listening to our guest today, Scott Simon, on Art in the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM. I think we want to move on to your book. We've talked about you, and I know you could probably go on for hours about the storied life you have, but let's talk about this book.
I don't, Larry, I have the advantage of having two daughters who couldn't be less interested.
Well, that's true, but I know how that is. In your family, you're not considered that anything. But first, I think before we move to your book, though, let's talk about, first of all, your wife, how you met, and a little bit about that story, and then we'll move on to the book, because they kind of are part of this book, too.
Oh, yes, our family is part of the book. Well, I'm looking across the room, because we're on book tour, at Caroline, and one of the many things she doesn't like about book tours is people who come up to her and ask us how we met. Let's just say we met at a party in New York and I fell in love instantly. Caroline needed a little more convincing, but I fell in love. I had never met anyone so funny, so brilliant, so beautiful, so everything. And that's still the case.
Well, I think you've made anybody who reads this book will fall in love with her and the family as well. So, Scott, when writing so personally as this book is, do you ever check in with family members or someone who might be mentioned in the book?
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. Particularly, to double check anecdotes and that sort of thing, yes. Absolutely. I have a couple of scenes in there where I describe our foster cat, Gato Blanco, getting right. loose, and had to double check that very carefully, as we all remembered in different accounts. And then another where the family hamster, Bagel,
right.
Winds up under the kitchen stove on a, what do you call it?
Glue trap.
Yeah. From which Caroline ventured forth like the French Foreign Legion and freed her with a swashbuckling slash of some scissors.
Does Caroline do the pre-read? Does she do any editing or?
Oh, yes. Caroline is a particularly gifted proofreader. She catches things that editors sometimes miss, and that might be because, of course, of her fluency in language. And did you learn how to read in French? I'm looking at Caroline. She sees English in a way that's different than the rest of us, who just sort of gloss over a different word.
Well, maybe at this point we'll have you read a quick sample from the book, and maybe give our audience a sample of what's coming up. Ulysses S. Cat.
Yes. Let me read from an early section. Penny. I was born into a family who had a dog waiting. We framed the first holiday card my parents sent out to friends and family when I was about 9 months old, plump and plum-cheeked, plopped onto a couch with thin dark hair flipped up like a duckling's and smiling. And what was there not to smile about? I was fed, changed, bathed, and with every whim catered to by the lovely Irish woman who was my mother. I was tickled, spoiled, and utterly entertained professionally by my father, who was a comedian. The face next to mine was large-eyed, interested, furry, and kind. It was Penny, our German shepherd, then in her late puppy phase. My parents sprawled across the card, "Some Simons are cute." I'm pretty sure they meant Penny. Penny and I actually figured into the same family anecdote before I was even born. My mother was beginning to display evidence of my impending arrival on a night when my parents were to meet friends at a restaurant in Chicago's Little Italy. They did not want to leave Penny on her own in the apartment, where they figured from experience she would whimper, chew the sofa, and gnaw table legs in anxiety, they thought. Then my father handed my mother a pair of sunglasses. "Wear these," he said, and put a leash on Penny. They must have been quite a sight when they entered the family-run restaurant. My mother, glamorous brunette, visibly pregnant and outwardly blind, clinging to the arm of her devoted husband, preceded by her devoted guide dog. "You could hear people gasp all over the restaurant," my mother would recall. "Look at that blind young pregnant woman," they'd say. "So beautiful, so sad. But say, aren't those guide dogs supposed to be trained a little better than that?" I should explain, Penny washed out of Chicago police dog training. My grandfather, Irish side of my family, was a Chicago police sergeant. And I'll just read this much more. My parents were seated at a long table with friends. Penny took up her position at my mother's feet. But when a platter of braccioli or faro malfadine was carried out from the kitchen, Penny would lurch, tongue lapping, nose quivering. "Oh, it's so beautiful," my mother would gush from behind her sunglasses. "Yes, dear," my father would admonish for all the other diners to hear. "The food sounds beautiful, doesn't it?" Owner of the restaurant finally came over to my parents. "You're not really blind, are you?" he said. "Well, we couldn't leave her in our apartment," my mother admitted. "She's just a baby." And the restaurant owner smiled as diners began to crawl out. "Oh, let the poor pooch stay. Keep her out of the way," the owner told my parents. "Any problems, we're tight with the health department inspector."
And that's from Ulysses S. Cant and Other Animals I've Known with Scott Simon. And the book's now available, isn't it? Is it pre-order, or you can actually, it's published?
It's already came out May 6th, so yes, you can order it right now. It's an Amazon nonfiction book of the month for May.
Wow, congratulations. So what's on our next book? Do you have that? I mean, you have a whole library of books that you've written, everything from the Cubs to the very touching thing that the Twitters exchanged with your mother and everything. What's next on the agenda?
I have a couple of things I'm working on I probably just superstitiously shouldn't talk about. But one a novel, the other, let's just say, a consideration of a comedian.
Oh, okay.
Plus some more Daisy haikus. I think there's a book in that, too.
Well, Daisy's haiku, I think, are an important part of this book. Ulysses S. Cant and Other Animals I've Known. It's got to be up to Daisy. Of course, there have been the inevitable feelers from all over the literary world. So it'll be up to her where she wants to sign.
Excellent.
Scott, is there something in life that you wish you had done differently, or another path that you have taken, maybe, that you say, I've been a journalist, I wish I did. Is there?
I believe you do. Yeah, Daisy thinks I should just be a journalist. No, I wouldn't be qualified to do anything else. I mean, would it have been fun to have been an astronaut? Yes, but I hardly qualified for that. I've been very blessed to have the kind of life that I've had in this business, and I don't think there's anything else I could do that I know about that could have gotten me around the world so much and given me the opportunity to meet so many interesting people and have such an interesting life and such a wonderful family.
Well, and then you have such a outreach to people. You have a wonderful family, and you can find out about that in the book itself and everything. But yeah, you've touched a lot of people with your, weekend edition, I think, is something that just, I know, something I look forward to every Saturday morning as I wake up. It's important. The soothing tones of your voice. I mean, you remind me much in the same category of Pat Hughes as the Cubs announcer in radio. You have kind of a similar quality. Well, in our last moments here, again, remind us where you can get the book and how they can find out more about you, like a website and things like that.
Well, I have my own website. That's ScottSimonBooks, all one word, .com. And you can get the book, I hope, anywhere. I mean, you know, Amazon inevitably, but I'm in Nashville as we speak, making an appearance at Ann Patchett's bookstore, Parnassus Books. I was in New Orleans last night at New Orleans Octavia Books. There are great bookstores in Chicago, obviously, where you can get the book. So it should be all over.
Well, Scott, we appreciate you coming on the show. The book is Ulysses S. Cat and Other Animals I Have Known, Scott Simon, and you can find it. And then there's also some wonderful line drawings in there that kind of tell
the story. By Leanna Fink.
Leanna Fink.
Beautiful drawings.
Beautiful drawings. And it's an easy read. It's a fun read. I mean, it's I can't always say that by author interviews that we do, but it was just, I sometimes did not want to put it down. Scott, thank you so much. Thank you for coming on Art in the Air and sharing not only your life journey, but this book with our audience.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Reitinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts, give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world.